wow, what is this? How do we get this?
Hi, I'm Becky Fraser, Campaigns and Communications Volunteer at the Scottish Fair Trade Forum, and you're listening to the Faircast.
So, you know, you can't really have social justice without environmental justice.
The danger is that we as consumers stop questioning brands and companies on the information that we're given.
They decided to take on the biggest brand in the entire world.
You'd love these guys. You've got to go out and meet them.
Welcome to our very first episode. To kick things off, we're focusing on two brands that are showing their different, fairer ways to produce two of the world's most popular products. Enjoy!
Hello and welcome. I'm Martin Rhodes from the Scottish Fair Trade Forum. And welcome to this first episode of the Faircast. I'm now joined by three guests, Jess Besson-Jones from Karma Cola, Albert Tucker from the Karma Foundation, and Scott Irwin from Green City Whole Foods. I'm going to start by asking you, Jess, just to say something about Karma Cola in terms of the business and its background and how it got started and what it is you do.
Well, hi, nice to meet you all. I run the UK team here for Karma Drinks. We're a really small team. There's about six of us down in London at the moment. And I guess the birth of Karma Drinks was actually over on a beach in Auckland from New Zealand. We're a Kiwi brand originally. And our founders over there having a surf, and they thought, what can we do to show to people that people in New Zealand will be prepared to pay a little bit more money for products that are premium and they're also ethical and they're sourced fairly? And so they decided to take on the biggest brand in the entire world, which is obviously that sort of big name cola brand that we won't mention. And through that sort of ambition of trying to show that you can do things right for people and by planet, they introduced themselves to Albert Tucker, who we also have here, who can probably talk a little bit more about how the cola itself was found and we started working with our communities in Sierra Leone. But that was really the birthplace of the entire brand, trying to show that people would be prepared to spend a little bit more money on products that are good for the planet and good for people.
I mentioned Albert there. You were there right at the beginning in terms of the product and its development. Have you got any reflections on that and thoughts about that or memories of that?
Yes, I think it was amazing. Sierra Leone had been coming out of a terrible conflict, and we were, many of us in the diaspora, working towards doing the supporting the economy and communities to do well. So I was going up and down there, but I was also very active in the fair trade in coffee, cocoa, in different farmer communities. So, and those founders that just talked about had been involved in bananas, along with myself, in when I as head of Twin Trading, which was behind Cafe Direct and Divine Chocolate. And then they approached me about, they want to make this fantastic drink that was organic, that had all natural ingredients, was fair trade, and lived up to its name of Karma. And they had the name Karma Cola already. But they were struggling to find cola nuts. Of course, being West African, cola nuts is very, very, very familiar to us from when we were children. So we agreed to work together using fair trade principles. But actually, cola, when we looked at cola, first thing a couple of the founders did was come to Sierra Leone. We agreed some of those principles were people who are communities who are working together. We didn't want to benefit a couple of farmers. We wanted benefit that would be spread around. So people who are working together already. We found this community who were in Sierra Leone with the help of a German NGO we connected with in Sierra Leone, who were protecting an island, an island with rare animals, 123 different species of plants, 23 primates and so on. And we sourced from them the cola nut. But then we found out a shocking thing, that cola, which gave its name to the drink, is not used anymore in its natural form, where artificial flavoring was being used. So therefore, the cola was very, very, very cheap in Sierra Leone. However, it's the most valuable crop there, that they use it for auspicious occasions and so on. So we engage with that community who we support, to who we work very closely with now, and they're doing amazing things. But what we found is we could demonstrate that even the most popular product in the world, we realized 1.7 billion units of cola are drunk every day globally, but none of that really benefits cola producers who gave their name to this product. So we thought that would be something we can change and actually make people aware there is such a thing as a cola nut, and it gave the drink its name. And that's been one of the driving passions for me anyway in the foundation and with the communities we work with.
Jess, Albert's mentioned there about the cola. No, people may not really be aware of it, where the name cola comes from. Can you tell us something in terms of the process of making your product, you know, the ingredients, the process, what's actually involved in making, and where is it made and grown, and the ingredients grown and the products made?
Yeah, of course. So I think across all of our cola drinks, as Albert said, the focus is on finding the very best organic and fair trade ingredients. So if you're going to have a fizzy drink, it might as well be as best as it can be for you. So that's everything from our sugar, which is always raw, unbleached, organic, fair trade sugar sourced from the best practices around the world. And then each drink itself, from our lemony lemonade through to ginger ale, and to the famous Karma Cola, are all made with natural, real ingredients, which we source from sort of all over the world, again, organic and fair trade. So each sort of can or bottle that you might buy of ours, you have this fair trade organic sugar, which is then built on with some obviously fizzy water, and then the real natural ingredients, that whether it's the cola nut, which we then also have some delicious vanilla from Sri Lanka, and ginger and gingerella. The lemons you find in lemony are all organic fair trade lemons from Sicily, and our Mexican orangeade is full of juicy, gorgeous oranges from the San Potosi region of Mexico. So that's really how we source and make our drinks, is we try and find the best ingredients we can with the best farmers that we can find, and build them up from there.
And when I introduced you there, I mentioned, Albert, you're from the Karma Foundation. Can you tell us something, Albert, about the foundation and what the foundation does linked to the business?
Yeah, the foundation, we have a small local team in Sierra Leone from around the villages, and we work with a committee of that represents 8 villages. Well, that's nearly 3,000 people. And they protect this island, as I said earlier. But also, they work together. They meet every November and decide what kind of things we support. The first year, when we approached them, to supply us with this cola nuts, and we said, okay, this cola nut is not really going to add much to you because they're so cheap. So, and it's not really fair trade yet, but let's create a foundation where we'll ask consumers to contribute. We've now shifted from, at that time it was 2 cents a bottle, we've now shifted to 1% of revenue to actually help the community develop. And we're very keen on sustainability, so that we work on things that they can sustain as well. But the first things they asked us for were 2 things. One, to build a bridge across the main village, because in the rainy season, the wooden bridge they have gets washed away. Kids can't get to school, vehicles can't get in there, and so on. So imagine, with our fair trade consciousness here, bridges are not the things we thought we were going to be building. So, but that's what they thought would be most useful in that first year with what we had, budget-wise. So we built that bridge, and it was a lifesaver for those kids and for the rainy season. Then they wanted us to support girls to go to school. Again, with our very Western approach, I went in and said, well, why aren't girls going to school anyway? They should be going to school. The school should be supported. But when we looked at it closely, and their response to me was 30 years now, that government hasn't improved our school infrastructure in the rural areas. And also families who, if they can't afford to send all their children to school, will only send the boys. In that main village, there's a female chief called Chief Caddy, who's the greatest chief executive I've ever come across. She manages that village very, very efficiently and inclusively, but she is in charge and knows what's going on everywhere. And she took me to one side and said, we're telling you that families who can't afford it, the girls don't go to school. We're saying if we have a bursary, we'll make sure those girls go to school. So we started with funding 15 girls, the bursaries for 15 girls to go to school. And they set up an education committee, which makes the decision on who they award that to. So as we sit here today, we fund 135 girls every year through school, right from primary school, right through to secondary school. The last couple of years, we for the first time had 2 girls. So one had gone to university to study medicine and nursing, and the other one's just gone to technical college to study teaching. And, you know, and we've built some classrooms, the various things which the community have wanted. We built 3 classrooms. We support some additional teachers. But also we support an entrepreneur fund, which they keep a revolving fund, which they keep revolving. And they have a committee that makes decisions about that fund. And we support 63 entrepreneurs in the 8 villages. And we've just started a health fund, which is for serious illnesses which people can't afford to go to hospital to. They manage that fund with a committee of three women and three men who make decisions on who gets access to that fund for hospital treatment or for medical bills that is not covered. So there's a range of things the foundation supports the community to do, but they do most of it. So when we do bridge building or school building, they provide labor and base materials like sand and gravel. And then we provide costs for concrete, we provide the costs for the irons and the technicians who can help them build it. So it's very much the community taking control. And the foundation, where then with Karma Drinks, we talk about what we're trying to do. The conservation element is very, very strong for us. We've got a forest there being protected and animals being protected by those communities. And we want to show that this is something we are willing to back the communities to do.
So much amazing work going on there in terms of the foundation across a whole range of areas. Come back to you, Jess. As a company, you know, how do you build in that important commitment in terms of the environment, sustainability to your production?
Yeah, no, of course, it's a great question. So I think Karma Drinks has always been founded on organic ingredients, which is a really important step for us in battling climate change, and also certified organics. We work quite closely with the Soil Association on that one. We're very proudly plastic free across our entire can and drink range, which was something that happened this year. And then another thing we work towards as well is we have just recently submitted our B Corp application. So that is the process in which we can then go through every single element of our business and make sure that we're doing right again for people and for planet. I think outside of organic and plastic free, there's always more to do. So for example, if you buy a case of drinks from our website, there's a carbon offset program where we protect the rainforest in the Amazon. And then there are future projects in the pipeline to work with Albert and the foundation on some exciting projects within Sierra Leone as well.
With any product, we need consumers. And Scott Irwin is here from Green City Whole Foods, who supplies these drinks to consumers. Scott, I just want to ask you, who buys it? Who is the market?
The market's quite varied. We've got institutions like universities and the catering customers, the cafes, restaurants, also more ethical retailers. So from all the way up to Inverurie, right down to Newcastle, Green City distributes across a variety of sectors. And we were watching the brand, as you do, like you have a wee nosy online, and it was like we came across Karma Cola, and it was like, wow, what is this? How do we get this? Because the branding is just phenomenal. And I think that as a salesperson, if you've got strong branding, your job's made easy. And it was about 6 months after we'd spotted them online that we saw they were actually coming over to do a coffee festival in London. So we don't usually corral our buying team towards a brand so strongly, but we had our buying team up against the wall going, you need to contact these this company straight away, that this is exactly this what we are after. And and luckily we got distribution across Scotland, and since then we've even actually started selling to other wholesalers. So that's opened up the pub and the bar and restaurant trade into areas that Green City doesn't really service as much as these other wholesalers. So it's definitely taken off, and the sales continue to grow.
That's good to hear. I think, Scott, there may be people listening who are not aware of Green City Whole Foods, its structure, and you know how long it's been about, and what sort of business it does.
Yeah, Green City is a worker cooperative set up in 1978, and it's a flat structure, so everybody has equal say, equal pay, so everybody's contributions deemed equally. We manufacture and distribute whole foods. That was our primary setup, and from there we're taking like a lot of fledgling young brands and Scottish brands. And we've also been involved with the fair trade movement since the early days. And I know Albert, I think, had a lot of connections with our old general manager, Martin Meteyard, I think was involved in the Karma Foundation. So there's another wee bit of synchronicity there. So we've been going for for a long period of time, and just developing the business along ethical and concern for the environment. And as a cooperative, we love the fact that Fairtrade is has this brilliant concern for community. It's one of the few vehicles for democratising the supply chain, and it's more a horizontal structure, but again, in terms of treating everybody in the supply chain equally. And I think the importance of the fair trade premium and allowing communities to decide for themselves where they want to spend the money. So that blew my mind when I first heard the Karma were talking about building bridges, connecting villages in Sierra Leone. I was like, I've never heard anything like that. You knew about the healthcare, clean water supplies, all of that, but actual infrastructure programs, it was like really, really inspiring. And I fantastic to be working alongside such a cool company.
Martin, can I also say that when Green City approached our sales team and started talking to them, our sales team got hold of me and said, "You'd love these guys. You've got to go and meet them." So I can remember I called Martin, who I knew was engaged with them, and he said exactly the same thing. "Oh, you'd love them. Get up there." So I still remember going for breakfast with the team. And it was an early start for me going up there. But actually, I had a great time talking to the team. And actually, Green City were very central to introducing us to Scotland in a very good way and a good network. So we've always had a very, very soft spot for Green City.
Certainly sounds like a very valuable relationship you've got between the business, the foundation, and also Green City, and a major supplier in terms of your products here in Scotland. In terms of supplying those products and going back to thinking about the consumers, how important is it to consumers in terms of the sorts of things you've been talking about, the environmental commitments, the ethical commitments, the commitments in terms of the work that the foundation's done? I mean, how important, Jess, do you think that is?
Yeah, well, it's been a really interesting summer for us. I think the pandemic has shifted quite a few people's opinions on what they're eating, what they're drinking, their community, who they're supporting when they're going to their local shops to buy their groceries every week. And at the same time, we have brands like that big name cola brand being voted or being found to be the UK's worst plastic polluter for the fourth year in a row, shortly followed by all the other ones. So the tide is kind of turning a bit on big brands who are polluting our country and they're not doing much about it as far as we can see. We have found this summer there's a lot of consumers seem to be looking for and actively seeking out brands that are trying to do the right thing for people and for planet, that taste great and look great and are also quite easy to find. So yeah, it's been really encouraging, I think. We've sort of a difficult year within food and drink, as everyone has had, and then it's been really positive to see people flooding back to good brands post-pandemic. So yeah, it's good.
What was the effect through lockdowns and so on, and how did it affect you as a business?
Oof, I mean, it's been a year. It was difficult. We were sort of not really in any of the major grocers or really online either. So we had a lot of our business was built through great cafes and restaurants or casual dining spots that we've had wonderful relationships with for the last 8 years. So then when everything shut for three months. And I'm sure that there are plenty of other suppliers who have had very similar stories to us. And then that sort of coupled with a lot of the just global supply issues that are going on at the moment. So cardboard shortages, CO2 shortages is a fun one for a fizzy drinks brand. There was aluminium for a bit. So yeah, it's been a long year, but I think it's really encouraging just to see the results from the summer and just see how much people are really supporting brands like ours. So we're getting there.
Sure. I mean, it's obviously been a difficult time, don't you say, for the food and drink industry. I mean, Scott, how did it affect Green City through the period?
Well, we were fortunate in a way that we had such a broad selection of sectors that we distribute to. So although the catering and the food service sector fell off a cliff, that we managed to build up sales, pick up sales via the retail and the institutions. So that we were quite fortunate. The downside of was that a percentage of our catering customers didn't make it back. So that was quite a negative side of things. And we've also got staff members that are off with long COVID. So So that, yeah, that has been, I think actually when you meet people that have like suffering from long COVID, that you actually see actually how horrifying this disease is. And it just makes you appreciate your own health, and I think that's the good thing about cooperative working, is that you stick together through thick and thin, and we are coming through the end of that, hopefully, and getting back to some form of normality. So yeah, it's been a hard couple of years, but as I said, we've been fortunate that the retail sector has been pretty strong throughout.
And Albert, how has the COVID pandemic affected the work in Sierra Leone by the foundation?
Well, actually in Sierra Leone, because the foundation was very close with the communities during Ebola, which they had, and we really supported health and hygiene training and preventative measures with the communities, as well as our development activities, which that community always appreciated. We didn't run away like many people did on their recommendations to us. They were very terrified that once people leave, they didn't come back. So when COVID hit, it's actually been weirdly a turnaround, because in Sierra Leone, over the period of COVID, I think they've had around 200 deaths in total. And the cases that have happened have centered around the capital city, for people coming in and out of the country, particularly from America. And they have a very high recovery rate as well. I think people are still trying to work out why that is. But in the communities we work with, they've been social distancing. You have not seen anything as amazing as watching builders build a school classroom in a socially distanced way, which they send me pictures of. But we also supported training for them on that and hygiene, and produced hygiene materials. And the communities themselves managed themselves in out of not having a case. So they didn't have a single case of COVID in the communities we work with. And they still continue to work in that way. When the chiefs met with me in June, when I went there, we were all socially distanced. So they're managing it, and they're managing it quite well. But perversely, they were more worried about us and our colleagues in New Zealand when they're hearing the figures of what we were going through, when they were hearing the stories of lockdown. And I think the thing with lockdown, I think as Scott just said, going to the communities, and they were interrogating me on the experience. And you suddenly realize how inured we've become to. When I was describing to villagers that people not being able to attend the funerals of their families, they were horrified. And they still, to this day, send us many messages of concern and greetings around COVID. So, yeah, so they've managed it in the villages very, very well. They don't allow strangers in who they don't know, or if you're coming in, they're socially distanced. And so they've been managing it with our help, our team's help.
Just before we finish the conversation, obviously it's been mentioned already by a couple of you with regards to, you've got a small brand and you're up against a very big player and some other big players as well. How do you ensure that your brand gets seen, that consumers are aware of it? You know, what is it that makes it something that people want to buy?
So I think with us, what we've always tried to do is, yes, we're sort of trying to take down these big brands one drink at a time, but also we can do that in quite a fun and playful way and not take ourselves too seriously. So I think if you see our cans sort of lining up within the grocery fridges, they're always quite fun and playful, and there's always something quite joyful about them, which kind of grabs people's attention. And it's also with the help of great partners like Green City, because we have a lot of stories to tell, being organic and fair trade and having our foundation. And it's whenever you manage to have a really great partner that can help work with you to get those into cafes and restaurants, people tend to pick up the drinks because they look great and they look really fun. And then they turn them over and they think, oh, they do all of these things as well. So we take a very sort of authentic and one-on-one approach with the way that we reach people. We tend to meet people, especially consumers, in like casual dining spots. So if you're having a delicious meal and there's this gorgeous drink on your table, and then you turn it around and you read all the good stuff that we do. We're just taking it one day at a time, one country at a time. So yeah, maybe in a couple of years we'll be there, but big ambitions from a small start, but we're getting there.
And I would say that what Jess says, you know, about we look good, we taste good, and we do good. But I think the look of the drink and the taste is also something that for me was very, very important. That idea that you can use natural, organic, fair trade products. And when you drink it, you can taste the difference in that there's not a sticky taste in the back of your throat. You don't sort of get hyperactive, even though you're drinking sugar, not at the same pace anyway. And it tastes good. It tastes, people often say, oh, that cola, it tastes like cola should taste, or ginger ale. And I think that's a great strength. But also I joke about one time I was doing dry January. I always struggle with dry January because I'm a football fan and I watch in the pub, and you go there and you can't hold a glass of water. You can't hold a kind of zero thing beer. Well, you could hold a Kamakola. It looks cool. You know, it does. It looks cooler anyway. And I think that's one of the things. And usually when people taste us, they say that. But also I would say that with all our drinks that we talk about the ingredients. We talk about people knowing what they're drinking so that they know they haven't got any E numbers in there or whatever else. And we just need to more and more with not as much resources as some of the others, talk about the fact that it doesn't have to be as bad as it is or as damaging for the planet as it is to enjoy a nice soft drink.
Thanks, Albert, and thanks, Jess, and thanks, Scott. I think really interesting to hear a story of a product committed to ethical production, a good quality product, meeting all those environmental and developmental targets and aims and so on. But also the message there about it actually being playful, joyful. It's a positive thing. Often when we talk about these things, we can get very much, and understandably so, very serious about them. They are very serious issues. But actually, in terms of getting that message out there and finding different ways of engaging with consumers and citizens on these sorts of issues is very important. That's something, for me, Kamakola does in terms of engages in that way through the product and through the design of it and through the message. Everything there is actually engaging people in a very positive way and engaging with consumers and citizens in that way. So thank you all very much for your time, and thanks for joining me for this discussion. I'm now joined by Matt Oliver from Tradecraft. Welcome, Matt, to the podcast.
Great to be with you.
First of all, just for those people listening who don't know, could you tell us something about Tradecraft and what Tradecraft does?
Thank you. Yeah, it's a real pleasure to be able to speak with you and to share a bit of our story. Tradecraft started 42 years ago when a gentleman named Richard Adams flew out to Bangladesh as part of Tear Fund's efforts around floods in that area in 1979. Richard discovered that the best way of getting people back on their feet was to help them trade their way fairly to sustainability. The story goes that he went around all the villages noticing that the planefuls of aid that landed in Bangladesh were leaving empty. And so he bought up all their jute products, crammed them into an aeroplane and flew them back to the UK, where predominantly people in churches set up stalls at the back of church and sold their products. And Tradecraft was born and Fair Trade Journey began. 42 years later, we've been responsible for innovating many firsts in the fair trade world. Fair trade cotton, the standards for that. We helped create the certification for fair trade and the Fair Trade Foundation itself. Fair trade wine, we're at the beginning of that. Fair trade charcoal, fair trade rubber, and fair trade palm oil as well. If you name it, Tradecraft was probably at the beginning of it, but with a desire that fair trade would be bigger than us. So that's why we want to work in collaboration. We want to work in cooperation and just take great joy in seeing any fair trade initiative anywhere globally.
So obviously, from what you're saying about Tradecraft has always been looking at in terms of innovation in fair trade. So I just want to ask, in terms of obviously one of the latest things you're getting involved with is around Bala footballs.
Well, it was just such a tremendous opportunity, really. I'd been involved in football for many years, and for the last 5-6 years had followed Bala's journey from a personal perspective. And then when they contacted us to say that they felt they'd taken the brand as far as they could, would we as Tradecraft be interested in being the new custodians of the brand? It was a particularly personal project for me to look into. And we felt that such a terrific amount of work had been done on creating a very strong brand and a really good product range. But more importantly, the opportunity to get fair trade into another marketplace, this massive world of commercial sport. And it would be just a terrible waste of all that work to see it disappear. So we're delighted to become the new custodians. And I use that word deliberately. We don't see ourselves as owners of Bala. We've taken it on, and we'll develop it as far as we can, and hopefully have a lot of fun getting into good trouble, challenging the status quo of the sports manufacturing world, and then see what's next for it. But that was really the essence behind it. This terrific opportunity to enter another marketplace, which is full of trade injustice. There's a lot of trade injustice in the sports manufacturing world.
Just in terms of two aspects that you picked up on there in regards to Bala, one is it's a manufactured product in a factory. So it's really just, what are the challenges and differences around that sort of product, as opposed to what many people will think of as typical fair trade products, which are sort of craft products or food products. So what are the particular challenges around that? And also, you mentioned the sports equipment industry. What's the challenge in terms of taking on some very big brands?
They're good questions. The challenges around manufacturing do have some similarities to food in terms of making things. But the big challenge from a fair trade perspective is there is no set standards for the commodity that makes up the ball. So you can set a price, can't you? The fair trade price, a fair trade minimum price for bananas or for rice or sultanas. It's easily done. And if the market peaks, then the price can go up accordingly. One of my great passions and passion of tradecraft moving forward in the next 40 years is to apply the principles of fair trade to anything and anywhere. If they're just, if they're right, if they're fighting injustice, we should be able to apply them to almost anything. So we can apply the principles of fair trade to any manufacturing process. That is, we can guarantee fair negotiation, that there's no child labor in the supply chain, that the environment is being looked after, and that there is a fair trade premium being paid on top of the price being offered for the boar, that the community gets to decide what they do with that money. I think they're the principles that we can apply that are universal. The difficulty is there's no standard price in any craft product or a non-food product because we work with lots of producers around the world in our history that make things out of recycled plastic or recycled saris. There's no set price for that. Likewise, there's no set price for the components of making the ball. The second part of your question around taking on the big brands, that's the fun part for me. Tradecraft has had a history of challenging trade injustice and the way that business is done in the status quo. I think for us, after 2 years of restructuring, of rebalancing, we're ready to grow again and to apply the things that we've learned in creating new supply chains to challenge the big brands. We did this before with the supermarkets around tea and around coffee. Now we're getting the chance to challenge the big brands, the big sports brands out there in the world of football initially. You only have to look at the price of the ball that's used in the Premiership. I think it's £125. I'd be amazed how much or how little is actually given to the person who makes that ball compared to the person who kicks it. And that's where we need to challenge. That's where we want transparency. We really believe in transparency at Tradecraft. So I think the challenge for us in challenging big brands is, can you be transparent? Just, you know, out of that £125 for that ball, how much of it is going to the producer? Be transparent about that. We do that on our coffee. We do that on our tea. We'll do that with our footballs as well. The second part of it is we can't hope to compete with the big brands in the way that they compete in that marketplace. We don't have the war chest for it. We don't have £100 million to spend on marketing or to endorse a top player to kick our ball. So we have a real group that we call the conscious consumer market that is interested in food, where their food comes from, but also is worried about every aspect of their life and where all their products that they consume come from, this conscious consumer market. And we really want to have a ground-up approach so that the same people that are worried about the coffee that they drink, the chocolate that they eat, are also worried about where the ball comes from that their kids play with in the backyard. And so we want to be able to give them a conscious consumer option ahead of the big brands.
And you mentioned there, when you're talking about the sort of underlying principles, one is about respect for the environment. Can you say something a bit more about how Tradecraft generally approaches that issue of respect for the environment?
It's a really complex thing when you start to look into the nitty-gritty of it. 40 years ago, we wouldn't have said we weren't concerned for the environment, but it wasn't the priority. It was all about fighting trade injustice and giving people a fair price for their product. We weren't too involved in the environmental impact of getting goods, say, to the UK, etc. Of course, that's changed, and rightly so. And we're on a journey of change. But it's not easy for a company like of Tradecraft size to tack to the wind. So we're restrained in many ways. So in a world that's looking for a solution for plastic-free tea bags, we work with a manufacturer, and we've got to find a solution with that manufacturer and work with them to get as quickly as possible to plastic-free tea bags. We have to sometimes, to keep our costs down on some of our products, we have to buy 2 years worth of packaging up front, sitting in our warehouse. And of course, now we want to be plastic free. We're faced with the dilemma of, do we bin literally thousands and thousands of pounds worth of packaging to go plastic free quicker, or do we use that up and find a solution? And we've chosen to be good stewards. And while we've been using up old packaging, every time packaging comes up for renewal, we've then sought a more environmentally friendly alternative. So the majority of our packaging now internal is all compostable. We've tried to remove as much plastic as possible. We did get rid of instantly all of the machines in our warehouse that created plastic pillows to protect the goods as they leave the warehouse. We've done away with that, and we use recycled paper in those cavities in our boxes at great expense to do that. But it's not always easy to do it as quickly as the consumer would like, unless you have a vast sum of money to invest.
And you're obviously there talking about in terms of what consumers are looking for, and you mentioned conscious consumers. In terms of the pandemic and COVID and how consumers have changed their way in which they shop, or the way they think about shopping and consumption, can you say something a bit more in terms of Tradecraft's point of view of the conscious consumer? Is it something that's going to become more important? Is this a growing group? Or are we going to see, as my budgets become tighter, actually price becoming much more important in terms of people's choices?
I think there's going to be a real tension between balancing price and what you want from a product. We're at a real tipping point, but I know there is a desire, an increasing desire, for people to know that what they have bought has been created right, if I could put it that way. For right in terms of the environment, right in terms of the producer, right in terms of me buying it and consuming it. That isn't going to disappear, but the tension will come about price, most definitely. Most definitely. I think, again, Tradecraft helped create the fair trade movement. And in that, we thought fair trade was the market 40 years ago. Now, very much, I see that fair trade is a segment of the conscious consumer market. So the conscious consumer ranges from the person who is passionate about fair trade or passionate about the environment in the same way we are in this conversation, through to the person who just thinks, I want less plastic in my packaging. Or I'm just concerned about the food that my children are eating. So we need to take them on a journey of showing what fair means in that setting. In the current language, and quite rightly so, we're talking about the environment. We're facing a massive crisis that we've got to act as quickly as we humanly can to try and save this planet. But people are not being mentioned as much. So in the fair trade world, we need to speak about the environment most definitely, but not excluding people and trade justice to people, which will also help them. So one of the things Tradecraft's doing in that is trying to help farmers go organic, for example, with our food products. We really think the future of fair trade is organic, just so that the farmers we work with can pass their land on to the next generation, the next generation, the next generation, rather than over farming.
Thanks, Matt, for that. Interesting to hear you talking about the next 40 years and that positive forward-looking approach from Tradecraft. And I think, taking from what you've said, some key elements there around transparency, innovation, and trade justice. So thanks very much for joining us for the chat today, Matt. And good luck with Bala and the rest of Tradecraft as you move forward. Thank you.
Thank you. We look forward to being able to bring some footballs to you soon.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed our very first podcast. Remember to like, rate and review. Thanks to everyone who contributed to this episode.
You can follow us on Instagram, Twitter and Facebook at Fair Trade Nation. Visit our website, scottishfairtradeforum.org.uk.
To finish off, here's our local soundscape of the week. You'll find out what and where it is, along with full details of our guests, on the podcast pages of the Scottish Fair Trade Forum's website.